dear to everyone, to my dear listeners, I like to express my great thrill to have my first program in this year. I hope it will set the tone for future programs. I wanted to wish the best progress and happiness to BBS Radio. And I'm very thrilled to introduce my very special guest, Dr. Judith Boyce. Just to give a very brief introduction, I like to say that this lady is deeply and uniquely diversified doctor. She, I believe, is a scientist and has this very open mind with a deeply substantial knowledge and marriage between conventional and non-conventional medicine. It will be hardly enough just one program to discover and to touch of all aspects of her accomplishments. However, hopefully it will be enough to get to some points and to see her vision and for us to have very useful conversation. Dr. Judith Boyce, you're more than welcome. And I would say that my very first question is, how would you clarify in a nutshell this invisible balance between traditional and non-traditional medicine?
I think of there being a spectrum of medicine. And if you think about a piece of charcoal and a diamond, both of them are made of nothing but pure carbon. And I think of the conventional medical world inhabiting the charcoal end of the spectrum. That's where I think of drugs and surgery being located on that spectrum. And mid-range, I think of the food that we eat, herbs that we take, supplements that we take, and then the far end of the spectrum, the diamond spectrum, are more energetic therapy. So things like visualization, meditation, acupuncture, flower essences, homeopathy, those all tend to populate the diamond end of the spectrum. And to me, it is a continuous spectrum. It's not like there's a barbed wire fence that separates different parts of that spectrum. And my aim is to draw whatever is most useful for a patient from that entire spectrum.
This is certainly a tremendously challenging process, especially for, I would say, a regular person, even though such a thing as a regular person does not exist. And jumping into some of your points in your book regarding green medicine, you are making absolutely correct observation that there are not two the same people. So I personally feel that statistics should be taken with a great, great care and perhaps somewhat skepticism. So how one would start to visualize him or herself in a very individual and self-caring way?
That's a really good point, because the one of the first things I start out with patients is by asking them, do you want to be healthy? And a lot of them look at me in a funny way and they say, well, of course, why would I be here if I didn't want to be healthy? But to me, that's not necessarily a given. Not everybody really wants to be healthy, or they may think they want to be healthy, and as soon as they see how much work may be required, they're not interested anymore. And that's fine, too. So for me, part of the very beginning of the journey of figuring out what will or won't help is to have a very clear picture of what full health looks like. I can't give anyone a one-size-fits-all definition of health, so I will often ask patients, okay, tell me what it would look like for you to be healthy. Like, I have one patient who his definition of health is running 3 Ironman competitions a year. And I have another patient, and her definition of health is, well, I want enough energy when I get home from work to be able to do some painting in my studio, and I want to ride bikes with my grandchildren. That's her definition of health. So each person needs to look, if they are interested in being healthy, needs to look at what health, if they could paint a picture of full health, what would that look like for him or her? To be fully and completely healthy, not just absence of symptoms, but if you had all the energy you wanted, you felt great, what would you be doing? How would you be spending that energy? What would you be focused on? That's your definition of health.
It certainly molds around our life, our individuality, of course, our profession, and all these issues which you bring in as extra, extra spiritual but yet practical applications with non-traditional medicine can adapt to your style of life. I would say that astronomical cost of regular medical care somewhat pushes us to be, if not more creative, but very conscious of what we really need to do. Is it a fair question, perhaps, to simplify, but to make it more adaptable for some regular base regimen which we can follow? Would you make some just a basic recommendation either for change or maintenance of your health?
Well, some of the absolute foundations that I think about, that they're pieces of a puzzle and no one piece is more important than another. One, and from, I'll address it both from Western and then a little bit from Eastern perspective, because I'm also trained in Chinese medicine. Our diet absolutely has a profound impact on our particular body. We know from computer work the adage garbage in, garbage out. We understand that with computers, but many of us think we're immune to that and with our physical bodies. So the diet that we have, the food that we choose to eat, the closer it is to the way that it came from the earth, the better. So, for example, potatoes come from the earth, but there's no such thing as a potato chip tree. So eating foods that are as close as possible to their natural state. Aiming for organic foods, we know from studies that organic foods tend to have about 70% more nutrients than conventionally grown foods. Drinking enough water, that's a huge piece. There are many, many people in this country who are dehydrated. There's a study done in Canada that showed that most people drank 70% of their fluids as coffee and beer, both of which are diuretics. They make us dump more water than we take in. So getting enough water and good water is another really important piece. Another grossly underestimated health support is sleep. There's some research that shows, one research study says 7.5 hours is optimal, but there's also other sleep research that shows most people need 9 to 10 hours of sleep. So resting and sleeping enough profoundly impacts our immune system, our ability to remember, and also to concentrate. So we might lose time sleeping more, but regain that and the efficiency of our work and how well we concentrate. And then exercise, moving, and I love to say movement rather than exercise because some people are scared by the word exercise, is important as well. And then finally, I'd say relaxation and having deep, quiet time is something we tend to overlook in the West. You know, our feet hit the floor and we go, and we don't stop moving until we get in bed at night. And in Chinese and many other Asian cultures, there's an understanding that there needs to be quiet, reflective time to put energy deposits back in the body. Meditation, Qigong, Tai Chi, prayer, any kind of reflective time, it helps to put deposits back in to the body.
I used to say if I had a good enough hours of sleep, I feel like a genius next day. So, exaggeration, but that I wish I will have more frequent experience like this. Speaking about what you just said, and thank you for such a comprehensive, touching base, all aspects, but I think imagination and some experimental thinking is great, not necessarily expensive or time-consuming. Just to impose a little bit and tell my little story, I discovered plantain, which you are mentioning in your book. And I thought that the plantain, when I saw it for the first time, looked like unripe, very hard green bananas. It was my stunning discovery that plantain is one of the wonder and just a fantastically rich in so many nourishments food. Could you tell us a little bit about plantain, how to prepare it? And it is so now inexpensively, and we can get it in the supermarket.
Right. And actually, I know the plantain that you're speaking of, and you can bake it, you can saute it. You can do all kinds of things with it, and it's a major part of the diet more in India and some other parts of the world. And actually, in the book, the plantain that's referred to is plantago, which is it's a little common plant that you'll find almost in every yard, and it's an herb, which is a bit different from the plantain that you're describing. They're both wonderful foods. They're both highly nourishing, wonderful foods.
Well, is it such a tincture or not to take much of a time from so many other wonderful things you're talking about, but is it possible to get such a concentration or in form of tincture? Is it available at the health food stores, for example?
Do you know that I have never looked for it as a tincture because I've always just taken the plants, harvested them, you know, from the yard. If there was someone who was making the tincture, the two most likely herb manufacturers who would be making the plantain would be Wise Woman Herbals or Herbal Ed or Herb Farm, and Farm is spelled P-H-A-R-M, Herb Farm. Those would be the two most likely ones to be making that tincture.
Very, very useful advice. I'd like to jump into more of a profound medical issues. Number of people are very concerned now with their genes. It's not a secret that there is a tremendously powerful research right now about the genes, of course, this cell treatment. And my question to you has to do with your vision and the knowledge. Are we able, if not to change our negative aspects of genes, or at least we can control some potential problems? What kind of a modern keys we have to use our genes to the best of our advantage?
There's been some fascinating research. You may be very familiar with this, by Bruce Lipton. And Bruce Lipton is a biologist who, in the late 60s, was finishing his PhD and working in a laboratory, and his supervising professor, made a comment to him that had very profound ramifications. The supervisor said, if you have any trouble with growing cells, look first at the environment that the cells are in. So he was growing different kinds of cells in Petri dish, and his supervisor said, look at the medium, look at what kind of nourishment the cells have. And Bruce really took that to heart, and he began to nourish the cells that, for example, stem cells that were supposed to turn into heart cells. And he would nourish them in certain ways, and they'd turn into muscle cells, or they would turn into skin cells. And so he was discovering that what we think of as completely rigid genes could actually express in a multitude of different ways. And his comment is that our genes respond to everything. That means from here to the end of the universe. So that our genes are actually much more pliable. And he also makes the point that those genes are more like the blueprint for a house. Once the house is built, you don't go back and look at the blueprint. You go about living in the house and repairing things if you need to. And that's the job of the actual cell. And the cell wall is to go about the daily business of maintaining the cell. So you can remove genetic material from a cell, and the cell will continue to live usually for at least 3 or 4 months. So the genes set things in motion, but they are definitely malleable. They can be altered, and so that they will express in different ways. So there are many things that we say, oh, well, that's just my genes, that's just my genetics. We know, though, that genes are potentials. The genes map out the potential for our health and for our physical vehicle. But what we do, what we think, what we eat, the way we conduct our lives, all impact those genes so that they can be modified over time. So our genes are not sentences, as in like a sentence handed down by a judge. They are actually a whole range of possibilities that we carry within ourselves.
So there is no excuse, really, to say, well, I have a bad genes, nothing I can do. that brings another point in your book, which I was very impressed with, because there is sometimes a controversial, a little bit of a hidden war between traditional and non-traditional medicine. You really clarified the meaning and usage of traditional medicine, especially when there is an emergency, especially when it's really called for this certain immediate medical conditions. And you distinctly, clearly describe the non-traditional medicine, how it can be crafted towards an individual. What particularly I liked is the fact that you said that conventional medicine, with all these medications and pharmaceutical approach to the medications, is for every person. So there is obviously a bottle, there is a prescription, everyone will use the same medication in the same way, when indeed non-traditional medicine will be molded and will be more crafted towards this individual needs. I particularly liked your comparison regarding Henry Ford, who mastered mass produce formula for the cars. So it did work for the cars very well, but right. Certainly mass production of the medicine not always works very well for the an individual. Can you elaborate a little bit how we can approach those two worlds?
Well, again, well, I'm going to aim to find the common ground, because in the conventional medical world, the medication is prescribed for a disease. And so I look at someone and I would say, oh, this person has high blood pressure, so I'm going to give them antihypertensives. And then it would just be a process of scrolling through the different, trying different ones, usually the diuretics given first, and then the beta blocker, and then the calcium channel blocker, and they go through kind of a protocol, and it varies a little bit from doctor to doctor, but it's basically the disease that's being addressed. And in what I call the classical medical world, and just this is a very, very simplistic differentiation, but the conventional medical world, I think, is looking at the body as more of a machine, and the what I call classical medical systems look at the body more as an organism. So a classical medical practitioner would look at the person and say, oh, here's a person who has hypertension. And they would then proceed to look at a whole range of different things about that person, their likes and dislikes, their diet, the environment they're in, whether they're struggling with a difficult family situation, or, you know, a whole range of different things. They'd look at the person who has high blood pressure, and from that perspective, then they would begin to make prescriptions. And it might be that those prescriptions would include an antihypertensive, but they would also address a whole range of other things about the person and the root for why they might have high blood pressure.
I was very fascinated by your observation, and I will let you to describe this particular example. This has to do with an eczema, which was treated, I believe, by cortisone. And indeed, right. On a cosmetic superficial level, it became better. However, the asthma took a very pronounced, stubborn shape. And that happened because the eczema, who was supposedly treated, was not really, went deeper, penetrated through the lungs and produced that on the surface unrelated problems, but deep down it was very two related issues. Can you explain and give us deeper understanding how seemingly unrelated medical problems indeed do relate?
Right. Well, that particular relationship between eczema and asthma is actually also recognized in conventional medicine. It's not well explained, but it's recognized. If you could imagine a flow or a movement in the body that first, when most of us, when we're born, we are in a state of balance, and also hopefully when we're in a state of health, we're in a state of balance. And then things come along that disturb that balance. So overworking could cause a disturbance or a grief or a physical trauma. And when the body is disturbed, generally it will produce some sort of an inflammatory reaction. A fever is an example of an inflammatory reaction. Eczema, the irritation on the skin, is an example. There are a whole range of different ways, redness, swelling, the body expresses the inflammation. If the body is allowed to go through the inflammatory process, the body generally will discharge the disturbance and go back to a state of balance. So, for example, when we have a fever, that's an inflammatory reaction. There's actually some wisdom in a fever. If we spike the core body temperature even 1 or 2 degrees, most bacteria and viruses can't live in that environment anymore. So a cold and a fever actually is a healing reaction. Most of us in the West are trained, though, to stop the inflammatory response instead of allowing the body to complete the inflammatory response and the discharge. So with eczema, as you mentioned, the common treatment is to put cortisone, corticosteroids, on the eczema. And when that happens, what was an acute inflammation, the acute eczema, is pushed deeper into the body. It becomes a chronic inflammation. And in Chinese medicine, there's a recognized and understood relationship that the lungs and the skin are related organs. So it's not surprising. It makes sense from Chinese perspective. And like I said, it's recognized but makes no sense from Western perspective that if you suppress eczema, you end up with asthma. And I've worked with countless patients that this was their scenario, their picture with their health, is that they had eczema, they put corticosteroids on, and then they showed up with asthma. When the body strengthens enough, it will push that chronic inflammation back up to the surface. I think about it kind of like lifting up the carpet and starting to sweep out things that have been shoved under the carpet. So when the body's strong enough, it'll lift up the carpet and it will push that eczema back up to the surface. Usually the asthma improves, the eczema is pushed back up to the surface. And if someone does not understand this relationship, they'll say, wow, my asthma's better, that's great, but now my eczema's back. And they put the steroid cream back on the eczema and the asthma returns. And if that goes on long enough, that ongoing suppression, eventually the body doesn't have the energy anymore to lift the carpet and sweep things out. And then the final stage of disease is degeneration. The tissue actually begins to break down. Degeneration is also, that end stage is also where tumor formation occurs. The good news, though, is that a lot of the things that we talked about earlier, eating well, working with a whole range of natural therapeutics, can reverse that progression, and the body can begin to heal itself, going back, scrolling back through the previous diseases, usually in more minor expression of the condition. Like, for example, when the eczema comes back, usually it's not as severe. It's a shadow or a lesser outbreak than the first time. And then if the body's supported, it can go through the discharge, and the body can go back to a state of balance or greater health after that discharge. And often that scrolling back happens over time. Thank goodness everything is not swept out from under the carpet at the same time. That would be horrible. So usually the body over time progressively moves a bit out and then reaches a new plateau and then pushes a bit more out and then reaches a new plateau. So it's an ongoing improvement over time in our overall health.
Cannot wait to jump to another issue, but I just wanted to ask your opinion. Our skin is the largest organ, and I think it's like a mirror of our inside. So whatever our skin shows outside, it's probably quite a good indicator what's going on inside. And frankly speaking, I don't want any cosmetic industry to hear me right now, but there is no secret that you can use the best, most expensive cosmetic, but if you really don't do at least a fraction of what you said in the beginning, no cosmetic really will help.
That's a really, really good observation. And actually, when patients come and they want to work on their skin, I'll say, you know, I'm going to give you some ideas and mention some things to do directly for the skin, but the internal organs have to be functioning well for the skin to be healthy. So I'm also going to focus on your internal organs. And if you're expecting a quick fix for your skin, you might as well leave now, because it's not going to happen. that the body usually focuses on rebuilding the internal organs first, and then the skin is saved for last. So it's a really good observation. All those other systems have to be working well for the skin to be healthy.
Yes, it's certainly that's the reality. Well, Frank, just like I was in our very brief conversation prior to the program, saying that indeed I thought the focus of our program will be on menopause, because your approach to this very well-known phenomena fascinated me, and I felt that you take menopause not just for what it is, but as a part of the big picture, part of the human life, not only women, but I'm sure men as well. So I like to make my own parallel, and perhaps it is a bit out of the line we're talking about, meaning medicine, but I like to make a little parallel with music, because very common musical shape is ABA, and the A, it's a burst of the musical material, introduction, establishment of it. Then B is a development, when all elements are trying to talk each other, fight with each other, and then there is some climax of victory, of survival of this fight. And then A is coming back as a code, as a conclusion, but in a different level, with all this experience of middle part. So the reason I made this parallel is because I believe subjectively that a menopause is that middle part, which is not only not the end of life, but I think if met with the responsibility and care and a true understanding, can prepare the final stage of life in a most wonderful way. Maybe even better than the first stage, because with more maturity, more experience, and more desire to live.
That's a lovely description, because I have a background as a musician, one of my past lives within this life. So that's a beautiful description. And actually, if you think about the way we are as children, we go through a tremendous amount of change between ages approximately 9 to 12 to 19 to 22. Think about the magnitude of change that happens during that 10-year period. And I think about there being a similar magnitude of change at the end of perimenopause, peri meaning around the time of menopause, the period leading up to menopause. From that period for the next 10 years, there's a tremendous amount of change. So for most women, the average age for menopause is 51.2, so around 51 years old. So think about the difference between 45 and 55 years old. There's a tremendous difference for most women in how they view the world, how they go about doing things, what's important to them. And same with men. Their transitional period is called andropause, when their hormones are fluctuating. It's not as clearly visible for men because they don't have bleeding or other outward signs to signal when they're making that transition. Some women might disagree with me, but it's not as obvious when men are making that transition. So there's been a movement in the last 5 to 10 years of saying, oh, if women want to be really youthful, they should keep their hormones the same from the time they're 25 years old onward. Well, to me, that with the analogy of the musical structure, that would be like having ABB, more of the same, ABB. And when we go through menopause, we actually go back to a hormonal milieu, a hormonal balance that's much more similar to the way we were when we were children. There's this wildness in between during our reproductive years. But when we go through menopause, many women say, ah, my energy is more even now. I don't have the cyclical fluctuation that I knew when I was going through my reproductive years, when we're building up the lining of the uterus and then shedding the lining. And in many Native cultures, the menopausal woman or elder is considered to have a very special view of the world, because she knows both linear time the ongoing same consistent hormonal levels that she experienced in childhood and again at menopause. And she also knows cyclical change that typifies the reproductive years. So she understands both of those approaches to time, both linear and cyclical. And men don't really have that opportunity to experience cyclical time in their bodies in the same way that women do. So the menopausal woman actually straddles both worlds, both understandings of time.
I honestly dying to know what kind of a music background you had, and only if you're comfortable, could you share this with us, because I have some additional thoughts about this, but tell us a little bit about yourself and your musical background.
Oh, okay. I'd love to hear about what you play too, Lena. But I have a background of being a classically trained violinist and went to the conservatory and played in a symphony orchestra, and then realized at a certain point that there were other things I wanted to do, and as most professional musicians would attest, you generally have to be practicing 3 to 4 hours a day and always have your instrument with you, and that just, I wasn't able to do that with the things that I wanted to explore. So I dream now. I actually have dreams about playing and am very envious as I sit and listen to other people playing in my dreams. So that's a part of my life I hope to recapture within the next 5 to 10 years, to be able to really spend a lot more time playing music again.
Well, following your philosophy of life, you have absolutely endless life, and music is certainly one of those endless friends we have for life. And if you would be a little closer, it would be our pleasure to invite you to be our guest, because indeed one spectrum of our The Music Garden Company has to do with seriously amateur musicians who are expressing themselves in a very free, musical, not only non-competitive, but very sincere way. So perhaps if our ways will cross, just wanted to let you know that not only you're welcome, you're most welcome.
Oh, thank you. I would be delighted. So we'll have to talk, make arrangements.
Yes. Coming back to menopause, I'm dying to ask you one question. Mm-hmm. Are animals having menopause as well?
Do animals have menopause? Now, that's a really good question, and I would assume yes. I say that without having the background of a veterinarian to know that for certain, but I would assume there would be a certain age when animals would quit coming into heat, mammals, when mammals would stop coming into heat.
Okay. I'm sorry interrupting you. The only reason I mentioned this, because to go a little bit in more of a science, if we can see more of a raw, with no much of a emotional attachment, fascination of that changing in animals' life, might be a little bit more clearer how physiologically it happens in the human life.
Right, that's a really good point. And I have never seen research, and it may be out there, but I'm not familiar with it. Like, for example, do primates go through menopause and andropause? I would assume so. And the reality that is that we also know from human culture and human records that this is a transition that's been with us from the beginning of, you know, human history. And it's also represented in many cultures, like, for example, in the Celtic culture, they talk about maiden, mother, and crone. And in Native American tradition, they'll talk about maiden, mother, elder. And so there's a long tradition of understanding that there are at least three distinct phases that women go through in our lives, and that each phase brings its own kind of challenge, its own kind of growth, and also its own kind of wisdom. And one of the things I'm passionate about in supporting women and actually going through as natural a menopause as possible is that each of those major life gates or life transitions potentially is incredibly rich in wisdom. I think about it as a time when I digest the previous period of my life. So women coming up to that 45 to 55-year-old range, digesting all of the wisdom and the experience that they've had raising children, starting businesses, working with their careers. And as they stand at that gateway to move into the next phase of their life, they can ask themselves, and now what's important to me? And now what do I want to focus on? So it's a time to really digest and then also to assess and focus the next part of the journey. And many of us just go crashing through those gates, like adolescents. We just go crashing through that gate without taking the time to pause and digest and then set our trajectory, set our path forward from that place.
What a full, rich description you just provided. It is very unfortunate and very unfair psychological state which a woman, unfortunately, using almost like an excuse not to take care of herself after the menopause. It's a notion that after menopause, the life is over because, after all, I cannot have children. Fortunately, my observation is that in our time, women have children at their later age, and even though teenage pregnancy is a huge issue, but women with a high level of intelligence and background, indeed, now much more resourceful physically and mentally to have children when they are much more mature. And that, I believe, brings them to the realization what you've been talking about, that they indeed see life in more confident, more crystal way. So I wanted to ask you, how do you feel particularly maybe specific either remedies or a specific natural assessment women can look forward during menopause and after menopause? Like over-earthy, I know, is a wonderful thing, but maybe some other recommendations you can provide.
Well, I could mention some nutritional things and then also focus on inner things, meditative, reflective things, and then also exercise. I think all three of those are really important components. One of the recommendations I make for menopausal women is to work with someone trained deeply in nutrition. And when I say nutrition, I don't mean pill supplementing, but food. Not all, but many nutritionists focus primarily on giving pills. And I'm talking about working with someone who can help you figure out what the best foods are for your particular body, because there is no single wonder food that's good for everyone. So, for example, I discovered years ago that I'm allergic to soy, and for years there was a craze about, oh, soy is so good for this and that and the other thing. And it is. It's wonderful as long as you don't have an allergic reaction to it. So finding someone who can work with you to tailor a diet that's really appropriate for your particular body is immensely helpful. The better nourished your body is, the better you'll be able to make the menopausal transition. And if you do start having difficulties, like hot flashes are the most common symptom for women in this culture, and just as an aside, in many Asian languages, they don't even have a word for hot flashes. And that probably has in part to do with the fact that they have naturally in their diet a lot more of the phytoestrogen foods. Phyto means plant, so phytoestrogens are plant molecules that are weaker than our body's estrogens, but they have some mild estrogenic support. So some examples of herbs that have some phytoestrogen activity are red clover, black cohosh. There are also some that actually have tiny amounts of actual estrogen, like pomegranate has tiny amounts of estrone. And then there are also a range of herbs that are called adaptogen herbs, and they help the body better adapt to stress levels. They do that in part by supporting adrenal function, which is the backup gland that makes a lot of hormones as our ovaries start to diminish and the hormone production. So examples of adaptogen herbs are things like ginseng, American ginseng, Korean ginseng, Chinese ginseng. There's also Siberian ginseng, licorice, rhodiola. There are a whole range of different adaptogen herbs. And then finally, exercise. We know from studies in this culture that women who exercise at least 3 hours a week, and that's not 3 hours all at once, but 3 hours over the course of a week, tend to have about 70% fewer hot flashes. So that's a really good incentive to be exercising. Plus, women who are exercising regularly tend to sleep better. A lot of menopausal women tend to have difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep. I have one friend who, after she transitioned through menopause, was only sleeping 2 to 3 hours a night. She said, I want to get on the rooftops and tell every perimenopausal woman, sleep now while you can. So eventually she did get things worked out, so she was able to sleep again. But exercise is really helpful to be able to work with hot flashes, increase bone density, improve sleep, and it's also really important for stress reduction. And finally, just to touch briefly on meditation and reflective time, many women who are having difficulty sleeping say that they've been able to make more peace with that lack of sleep by taking that time for meditation or reflection, whatever your particular spiritual approach or tradition is, so that the body's actually deeply resting even though you're not sleeping. Plus, it's a way of cultivating and digesting, like we were talking about earlier, digesting life experience and also beginning to set the compass for the new direction in one's life. So all of those components are really helpful. And the last thing I'll mention is, from Chinese perspective, the more heating foods that you eat, that not literally food temperature hot, but the effect in the body, the more heating foods that you eat, the more hot flashes and insomnia you'll tend to have. And a lot of our favorite foods tend to be heating. So, for example, coffee, caffeinated drinks in general, alcohol, and also a lot of animal products, particularly chicken. Chicken is one of the most heating foods, meats, from Chinese perspective.
I need to tell my guests that I have true privilege to have Dr. Judith Boyce, whose work was recognized around the world and was noted by many other doctors, one of which is Bronnie Siegel, whose legend name had to do with theory and approach towards love of medicine. And he was one of the authors who actually brought us everyday human being to realization how love and true medicine are inseparable. And I believe that Dr. Judith Boyce has not only the same philosophy, but has her own vision, her own depths and very clear, transparent appreciation how medicine, with its wonders and scientific knowledge, can relate to everyday life, particularly when we've been talking about transitional points in life using menopause. I believe that we do not even need to wait for menopause or talk about this. We are in a transitional moment right now in a world where technology certainly is challenging our emotional, nervous system. And I think because of that reality, Dr. George's Boyce's work that much more valuable. We are coming to the final segment of our program, and I like to certainly give enough time for Dr. Boyce to give her website address and to talk about her last two major books and her future. But before doing so, I like to talk about children. This is particular great passion of mine. I'm dealing with education and emotional and physiological development, and this facing stressful time which our children are exposed in every day life certainly need to be addressed through food and through hygiene of life. Are there any experiences you particularly have with parents who wanted to change their children's life, to make them not only healthier, but just to bring them to mental realization what is good for them and what is not.
Well, that's a great... If and when I can answer that fully and completely, I will be totally enlightened. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I have twin 10-year-old boys, and during most of their 10 years, I've been a single mother. And I remember when I was pregnant with them, I walked into a store where there was something. It was before the popularity of the Internet, when things this kind of thing would have been all over the Internet. It said 10 things to know or practice before you have children. And there were things like practice changing clothes, get a very angry small octopus and stuff it in a net bag, you know, things like that. And the final one that really stuck with me, it said, pick up the phone and call everyone you know with children because it's the last time you will be certain about anything. And so I'm going to offer my advice with the understanding that parenting is one of the most humbling journeys I think anyone can undertake. And that the advice about individualizing, I think, is absolutely paramount with children because what works for one child, even in the same family, may not work at all for another child to support them and being their healthiest, fullest self. I have a son, for example, who has had a lot of difficulties with what could be labeled ADD or ADHD. And one of the things we discovered, and this is an example, again, of the importance of food, I did some food testing with him and discovered that one of the major foods he reacted to was eggs. And so we took eggs out of his diet. And the next day he came home with this paper crown on his head. And I said, where'd you get the crown? What happened? And he said, oh, kindergarten. He said, my kindergarten teacher told me it was the best day ever. So taking that food away helped reduce the irritation and inflammation in his body and particularly in his nervous system, so his behavior changed a lot. It didn't magically take care of everything, but his behavior was radically different when he started eating foods that were good for his particular body. And again, there's the importance of individualizing. So part of the overall plan for me with my children is to find the optimal diet, to individualize their diet, also to notice the different kinds of nurturing, emotional nurturing that they respond to. One of them really likes cuddling and physical contact. The other one, it's more doing things with him and playing with him in certain ways. And so I think a lot of the job, the journey of a parent is to both, in walking two paths at the same time, both discover ways of interacting and supporting each individual child and also communicating my needs as a parent to the child. It's not completely a one-way street, that children eventually also need to learn reciprocity and understand that their actions and behavior impact other people as well. So I wish I had some kind of blanket advice for parents, but my sense is that the core of being a good parent, if there is such a thing, and as someone said to me, that the job is to be a good enough parent. So in the journey of being a good enough parent, a lot of it has to do with listening deeply to the child and also inside myself to be able to know the middle path for what's best for me and the child.
You just used this beautiful, I would say, musically sound phrasing, which is in your book, listening deeply. We're using that very often towards music, and yet it is just as important to have that sensitivity towards us. To sneak a little bit of my own experience, I also was a single parent for a number of years, and when I came to this country, indeed my son had this excessive amount of mucus. He was sick from one to another situation, and I was extremely frustrated. I didn't want to give him an antibiotic, thinking that this is vitamin C. So finally, with tremendous luck, we did find nutrition. And what discovery that was, that all milk products he could not digest. And the changes are so, so difficult, especially if you're coming through some changes of your cultural roots, of your habits. And when I took away dairy products, my parents thought that I'm insane. But sure enough, after 5 months, his mucus was reduced, perhaps more than half, and he became certainly a much, much happier child. So what you brought up, it is certainly not possible to be a perfect parent, but we do not need to be a perfect parent. We just need to listen deeply. I would say that on this note, I like for you to tell us where we can find you, what are the major books which you would recommend for us to read to move forward with this program, and I will ask you to give your website.
Thank you. Although, if you're interested in menopause, and actually the book is also helpful if you're making major life transitions in general, especially the last part of the book. That book is Menopause with Science and Soul, a guidebook for navigating the journey. And that one actually won a Nautilus Book Award for books that changed the world. And the most recent book, if you're interested in caring for your family or your and or yourself more naturally, and to be able to actually build health as well as take care of acute conditions, The Green Medicine Chest, Healthy Treasures for the Whole Family, is available now. You can find the menopause book at pretty much any bookstore or online site. By the end of this month, The Green Medicine Chest will also be available at pretty much any bookstore or internet book sale place. And you can also find both of them and many more books on my website, which is www.drjudithboyce.com.
Well, what a delightful program that was, so informative. It's, again, my privilege, my pleasure to say until soon, not goodbye, to Judith Boyce. And I will wish her, with all of us, a wonderful, happy, productive, and creative new year. So until soon, I will shift into my musical note, and hopefully we will speak again with Dr. Joyce.
Thank you very much, Lena.
Of my first program of the year with the wonderful special music of Julian Lampert. We hope that he will compose many more compositions, not only for the radio, but for some other events. And again, I wanted to wish all my listeners and my wonderful helping power and PBS, wish them again successful year with many more exciting moments from us hosts. With all of that, be well. That was Lena Life. I'm Lena Miermont.